If you wake up in the middle of the night, you can push a button to see what time it is. But back in the 19-teens and 20s, there was only one way to make a clock glow in the dark, and that was to paint the numbers with radium. It was delicate, finicky work, and radium dial factories hired young women to do it. They were taught to keep their brushes sharp by lip pointing, which basically means sucking on them. Of course, radium is radioactive. The girls got horribly, gruesomely sick, and they began dying. And the companies refused to do anything about it. So the girls fought back in court. Writer Kate Moore tells their story in The Radium Girls. She says she could not stop thinking about them.
I was transfixed by this extraordinary true story of women fighting for their rights. And I was really struck that as the girls are lip pointing, putting their paintbrushes between their lips, and you know they're swallowing radioactive substances, you're reading what they're doing and you're thinking, no, don't do it, in the same way that if you watch a horror movie, you just think, you know, the young blonde heroine as she wanders down that darkened alley and you're thinking, don't do it. You feel the same about these girls.
You described some wonderful scenes. So radium, it's glow in the dark. As we said, it made the girls literally glow and shine. And they loved that.
They did, absolutely. Because they thought it was completely harmless, which is what their managers told them, they themselves would actually use some of that paint as makeup. They put it on their eyelids for eyeshadow. They paint their teeth with it. There was a report.
Why would you want glow-in-the-dark teeth?
I know. It's slightly strange. But they would. And, you know, Catherine Wolfe, one of the Illinois dial painters, talks of how the women would wear their good dresses to the plant because after they finished work, they'd go out in the dance halls and the radium girls would be the ones shining and shimmering with this ethereal glow as they're twirling and dancing to the latest jazz tunes.
I just have to say, there's the headline of one article I read said, "Still glowing in the coffin." Are they all still glowing in their coffins?
Well, supposedly radium has a half-life of 1,600 years. So it will still be emanating its rays, even as we're speaking here 100 years on.
Who was the first girl to die of radium poisoning and what happened to her?
Her name was Molly Maggia. So it started in Molly in her teeth, which was true of many dial painters. She had a bad tooth that was hurting her, so she went to the dentist and he extracted it. But then her next tooth started to hurt, and then the next one. Even after they took the teeth out, she'd have these ulcers that would seep pus. And so she goes to the dentist, absolutely desperate for some kind of help, for some kind of ease to this excruciating pain that she's suffering. And she indicates to the dentist that it's her jawbone that is hurting. And the dentist reaches into her mouth with his hand and gently probes at her jawbone. And it breaks against his fingers. And he is able to lift it out of her mouth because the radium has destroyed her jawbone. That's her lower jawbone. And a week later, he does the same to the rest of the bone in her mouth. And just to explain what radium does, so it's a bone seeker. Your arm bone, a leg, your hip, your spine, once the radium was inside those bones, it was shooting out those radioactive rays that we know it has. And it was actually making holes in the woman's bones. So when the doctors studied them, they found that they were honeycombed and moth-eaten. And so what Molly Maggio was trying to treat with aspirin was her, you know, her bones were literally having holes drilled in them. Catherine Sharp, one of the radium girls, said that the pain could only be compared to a dentist drilling on a live nerve for minute after minute, hour after hour, for days, weeks, months at a time. That's what she said the pain of being a radium girl was like.
And in the meantime, the girls would go to the companies, and the companies would say no, or they'd say you're imagining it or you're making it up. And they paid doctors to testify against the girls. The level of the cover-up is kind of hard to believe.
It's really quite shocking. As you say, the depth of depravity to which they would sink. They hired private detectives to dig up dirt on these women. They actively lied to them. They concealed medical test results.
There's one, I think you wrote, that At one point, they tested a lot of the girls for their radium levels. They didn't give the girls the test results, but they themselves created a list of who was going to die first.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened. They graded them depending on how radioactive they were. And so I saw in the archives when I was researching, it's there in black and white, a list of all the women's names and a number next to that name, you know, from 1 through to 5. And 1 is the highest radioactive, you know, radioactivity level you can have. I found them because I'm researching decades on, but the girls themselves that this directly involved were not only not shown those results, they were actually told, you're fine, you know, we've never found any trace of anything approaching radium poisoning. And they've got those results in their possession.
I don't see how somebody could look at a woman, a young woman, and know she's going to be dead in a year and look her in the face and say, you're fine.
And just to cite you an example of just how little they really thought of these women, there's one woman, Mildred Cardo, who died only 6 months after she'd been married. And the firm offered her husband a settlement. They said, if you absolve us of all responsibility, we will give you some money in return for your wife's death. But the sum they offered him was $43.75.
Oh, my God.
That just says it all to me. Less than $50 for a human life.
Kate, I can't imagine your own emotional trajectory, what it must have been like doing this research. As you said, finding a sheet of paper with the girls' death dates written down as a kind of corporate calculus, you know, or later I know you found many of the girls' original letters that they had written to each other. What was this like for you?
Incredibly emotional. I still get incredibly impassioned about it even now. And I actually wrote with pictures of the girls around my desk.
Can you pick one of your favorite young women to tell us about? Just introduce us and, yeah, tell us about her.
Okay, well, it's very hard to pick just one, of course. But I will pick Catherine Wolfe Donohue, who was one of the Illinois dial painters. She was Ottawa-born and bred, so she grew up in the town in Illinois where the dial painting studio opened in 1922. Catherine was 19 when she started work there, and it was her first job. And she worked there for 9 years. She was actually fired for being sick. She had a limp, basically, because the radium had settled in her leg. And they said her limping was causing talk. You've given 9 years of your life to a company and they fire you for being sick, but they've caused the sickness. That was a very big mistake, because what Catherine Donohue did was that she fought back. And it takes years. So by the time that Illinois women are filing suit, it's the Great Depression. And so the town turn against her and the women are disbelieved. They're shunned. They're told they're liars and frauds and cheats. And the families I spoke to when I was interviewing the families for the book, they certainly believed that there was a cover-up in the town. There were 41 lawyers listed in the town directory at the time Catherine was trying to file suit. Not one of them took the case. She had to go to Chicago to get a lawyer, Leonard Grossman. And by the time the case comes to court, Catherine is incredibly sick. She has a sarcoma, a bone tumour on her hip caused by the radium, and it's the size of a grapefruit. The doctors talk about her white blood cell count, which should be around 8,000, and she's only got a few hundred. So she's incredibly weak, incredibly frail. Her teeth are falling out. Her jawbone is crumbling in her mouth. She is close to death. And yet Catherine gives evidence on her deathbed. She's too ill to actually physically go to court. So the court comes to her, and in her sitting room on East Superior Street in Ottawa, Catherine lies on her couch with a blanket over her, and she gives evidence in a weak, faltering voice. She can barely open her eyes even as she's giving her testimony. And it's too late for her. Radium poisoning is fatal. She knows she is going to die, but she does it for her friends, and she does it for her family, for her children, for her husband. And I just think that is just a shining example of what these women did. You know, as you say, their bodies were crumbling, they were impoverished, they were facing certain death, they were grieving from the friends they'd lost, and yet they stood up, they fought for their rights.
Wow. They did win in the end. The Supreme Court did finally rule against the company. What happened next? What happened to the company and to the remaining girls?
Unfortunately, yes, they did win. It was ultimately largely a moral victory. There was basically only a pot of money of $10,000 for the women to split between them. But this case, the Radium Girls case, was a landmark case. It was one of the first cases in which an employer was found responsible for the health of its employees. And along the way of the Radium Girls fight, they were changing laws. Hundreds, thousands, millions of other workers were protected. And so I hope what the Radium Girls book does is to give these women a voice, and that showcases that it isn't just a heartbreaking story. It is actually a story of courage and of strength.
Kate Moore. Her book is called The Radium Girls, The Dark Story of America's Shining Women. So I don't know why, but this story really stayed with me. I just couldn't stop thinking about those girls, maybe out of some kind of identification or empathy. I think every woman has had the experience at some point of feeling like their personal reality is being dismissed by some kind of authority figure. Somehow I just felt like this story was not done. And that turns out to be true, which is how I wound up standing in a graveyard in Ottawa, Illinois, with the descendants of two of the Radium Girls.
My name is Darlene Holm, and my aunt was Margaret Looney. My mother and her sisters called her Peg.
My name is Kathleen Kofoid, and my great aunt was Catherine Donahue.
It's a perfect summer day. The cemetery is a little ways out of town, on top of a hill. There's a guy on a riding mower keeping things neat, and some simple, unremarkable gravestones.
Lot, this is my grandfather, grandmother. This is Peg.
1904 to 1929.
Yes, spent a lot of time here. As a child, we would come, we would bring flowers, and remember coming here with my mother and my aunts. My sister and I would run around.
And what was it you were telling me about underneath this stone, she's buried in a lead-lined coffin?
Yes, yes. When they exhumed her, they took her to Argonne National Lab, and when they brought her back, she is in a lead-lined coffin, although one of my aunts, she always thought that they never returned the body.
So there may be a lot of radioactive bodies here in this cemetery.
I'm sure there are. There was a gentleman, his name was Ken. He used to have a Geiger counter, and he would walk around the cemetery, and he could tell where each of the dial painters were buried because the Geiger counter would go off. And it's so peaceful here, and it's so pretty, and no one would think.
Ottawa, Illinois is a pretty town of about 18,000. It's got a leafy main square, site of the first Lincoln-Douglas debate. Most of the radium dial painters lived their whole lives within these few square blocks. They went to school and church here. The radium dial factory shut down in 1936, but the building itself, contaminated and radioactive, stood here for decades.
Well, see, I lived down the alley from the radium dial. And down in the basement where they had stored the radium, they actually put a meat locker down there. Many people bought meat from the meat locker, and I can go around the neighborhood to families that lived in each and every house, and at least one of my friend's parents, if not both of them, died of cancer. They did tear down the original radium dial in 1969. I was in high school, and I would come home from school, and the dust from the building would have seeped into my parents' home. It would be on the windowsills. We would have to vacuum. We would have to wipe everything down. Then after that, when both of my parents die of cancer and I see other people in the neighborhood and they are dying of cancer, it really makes me wonder. How could it not?
And guess what they did with the radioactive rubble?
They used it as fill. They dumped it all over town.
Wait, they just took all the remains of the building, which would have had a lot of radium?
Yes.
There's probably elements of that building not only buried all over town, but people might still have souvenirs.
Here's another thing I find unbelievable. While the Radium Girls were dying, the factory owner closed up shop, moved three blocks away, and opened up again, but under a different name, Luminous Processes. They used a slightly different painting technique, but the radium was everywhere. On workers' clothes, shoes, fingers. They got cancer at twice the national rate. And yet, the factory stayed open until 1978. When the EPA moved in, there were radioactive hotspots all over town. Ottawa, Illinois became a Superfund site.
You know, when I was a kid, we lived up on the north side and where some of the areas that they dumped the waste. When your neighborhood friends' houses are getting dug around with guys in spacesuits, basically, is what you thought when you were a kid. You know, they're digging up the whole neighborhood, but they're saying, oh, it's fine. You can just still live there in the house while your whole yard and everything is going away. And so a lot of kids through the years, because of playing and all that, they all had ill effects from it, too.
How many people in town do you think know this whole history?
A lot of people don't. Yes. There are a lot of local people, a lot of people that I've talked to in Ottawa, and I got a lot of comments from people. They did not know the story. They had lived here their entire lives.
No, people don't talk about it.
There are a few signs that that may be changing, though. A new brewery opened up recently, founded by four local guys who named it Radium City Brewing, in honor of the dial painters. And there's a new statue in town with a fountain.
It represents a radium girl. There was a girl from Mendota that had done a history project on the radium dial girls. She actually spearheaded that we needed a monument. And so the city worked with her. The city worked with her, and they decided to put the monument here, kind of an out-of-the-way spot.
But yeah, I bring my kids down here and whomever else visits because it's important that they know. It's not just our family history. They should know what happened to women, you know?
Do you feel betrayed?
That's kind of funny. I don't know if I feel betrayed. I think they betrayed the whole community. I think they betrayed the trust of women. I think they betrayed the future of our community because it's still here and it's still a problem. That's why I find it frustrating that the city is allowing people to build because it's the same foundation. There's a new business going in right next door. They want to build a family business that's going to serve ice cream to the community. There's no way that I would allow anybody I know to go there and purchase anything.
Kathleen Kofoid and Darlene Halm were born, raised, and still live in Ottawa, Illinois. They're descendants of two of the original Radium Girls.